Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Joining us here in New York City is Kate Moore, BlackRock Investment Institute Chief Equity Strategist, and she joins us now. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Some optimism this morning in China. Do you have it longer term?
I definitely have it longer term. And I think that some of what we've seen in terms of the price action so far has been really, really overdone this year. You know, I don't understand why investors are surprised that the government has come out and said that they are going to support strategic industries, technology, private firms, going to provide both explicit and implicit support on financing as well as on the regulatory side. This has always been the case. And people who have been reluctant to invest in China are those that don't understand the strength of Chinese political will and how important the growth and the breadth of the economy is for the future plans.
So we saw the plunge protection team get into action in 2016. What have they learned from 2016, and why is this response any different?
So I think what's happened in 2018 is a little bit different in that the government has put a series of policies and new regulations in place that, you know, while hurting earnings maybe a little bit in the near term, especially around some of the key sectors in China, actually really lay the groundwork for more sustained and better growth in the future. This isn't just about supporting stocks right now. This is about creating the right framework and the long-term support from the, you know, the policy side that will allow the kind of growth and development that they need to achieve their big technology goals.
Within all the, you know, the optimism we have, and John, we heard Kate Moore's optimism here over the last number of hours. But within this optimism is a gloom crew. Doug Kass will join us later on. Doug Kass is a little bit cautious on the market. What do the cautious people get wrong? Is it financial? Is it mood? Is it the size of the bet one way or another? What is it?
Yeah, Tom, let me just say, I don't think I'm going to live this down when I get into the office today. Kate, you're too optimistic is going to be branded right across my face. But here's what I will say. The people who are very pessimistic are concerned that, you know, all of these policy things will weigh indefinitely on the potential for earnings and growth. People who are optimistic, you know, tend to have a slightly longer time horizon.
Exactly.
It is super possible.
And Doug Kass would say that. That Kate Moore's x-axis is way different than the kind of axis Doug Kass is doing.
Don't allow us to characterize what you're saying, Kate. If it's not optimism, what would you call it? How would you frame the way you're thinking about the world right now?
I'd say I have the ability to look through some of the near-term noise. Volatility and some challenges and some headwinds to Chinese sectors and to Chinese growth expectations is very likely in the near term. And if I'm going to be totally honest with you, I can't necessarily identify a catalyst that's going to lead China to rip and outperform the rest of the market in the fourth quarter. But I think, you know, as especially longer-term investors and individual investors think about their allocation to this incredibly important economy, to these really interesting markets where companies don't look exactly like their U.S. counterparts, they need to think about adding over the medium term. And, you know, this is what you hear me say, which is to try and reverse the negative, or take away the cloud that's been hanging over a lot of people's recent experience in emerging markets and say there are some very, very strong growth stories.
So big week for tech earnings in the United States this
Huge,
week. The divergence, though, in 2018 between Chinese tech and U.S. tech has been absolutely massive. Are you saying that you would buy the Chinese side of the story and look for some convergence here?
It's really convenient to say that U.S. company, U.S. tech and Chinese tech are kind of similar sides of the same idea. But the composition of these companies, their demand, their content, the regulatory environment are all totally different. And you've seen what is almost 4,000 basis point spread between the performance of U.S. tech companies and Chinese tech companies.
Yeah, but are they, come on, is that apples to apples or, you know?
It's not. These are, you know, My point is, if you're thinking about technology over the long term, you got to own both sides. These companies do different things, access different consumer bases, and are developing technologies at different paces. It's not, you know, you don't have an Apple in China or, you know, an Amazon in China.
That was smart.
I feel pretty caffeinated for a Monday morning.
You did
morning.
It on accident, yeah. Tom.
She does stand up on the Upper West Side on the weekend.
Kate is much sharper than us. Kate, we just talk about that big week coming up for tech earnings. What are you looking for? Netflix just does everything the bulls want it to do, and then the stock ends the week down 2%.
Yeah.
Well, we're in this market where if you are putting up numbers that look too good, everyone's going to step back. Is it possible that we continue to get the same kind of subscription growth? Who knows? We really are looking for Goldilocks numbers, things strong, but not so strong that they don't look unsustainable. Yeah. And, you know, it's possible that good numbers this quarter, on the top line and the bottom line, aren't met with huge outperformance. So, but I would say that's an opportunity, especially our growth managers are looking to add shares at this point.
Does it matter what corporations are doing with their cash? Because to me, it's what my official line interview after interview is, nothing's changed. Mm. And they're doing a little bit of CapEx and everybody stands up and cheers. But it's a yeah, but kind of CapEx. It's no big deal.
Well, the only CapEx we're really seeing grow in a meaningful way in 2018 is in tech, actually. Every other sector is kind of doing what it's done for most of the post-crisis period. It's like low single digit growth, just what they need to do.
It's really interesting to me, though, that when growth starts to underperform, we get a lot of people come on this program and say it's time to shift to value. That rotation is here. Get out of growth, go to value. And then you just said your growth managers are looking to add to exposure.
That's clearly
for BlackRock, that's the theme. You think growth is where it's at, that's where it stays?
Yeah.
So last week we had a great debate. We had our equities offsite, and value versus growth was one of our key discussion points.
What did you see? Houston Red Sox? Is that where your offsite was?
Well, there are a lot of different teams here. This is what I'm going to say.
Okay.
When it comes to value, you tend to have value as a style outperform when you are in an economic or accelerating economic environment where the second derivative of growth looks really good.
Right.
And that has been, you know, the experience that most people have lived through. What I will tell you, though, is that like what's falling into the value style indices right now, some of it's just not very good quality, and some of it is structurally impaired. And I think our value managers would say, you know, the work they have to do is that much more difficult than it's ever been in the past. We are also, while we're looking for a sustained expansion, are not looking for a massive acceleration in the growth rate at this point. And that, I think, you know, tempers the opportunity for value.
John Hudak with us with Brookings. We talked policy after the election. Do you just assume, John, I mean, you're not like a poll wonk, but do you just assume gridlock, Democrat House?
Yeah, if the Democrats take back the House, sure, gridlock is going to increase dramatically. You're going to have one party controlling the House, another party controlling the Senate that agree on next to nothing.
Yeah.
And unless Pelosi and Schumer can somehow extend an olive branch to the president, it's going to be a period in which we have another do-nothing Congress.
Is gridlock good?
Well, gridlock is good if Congress is proposing a lot of bad ideas, and I think there are a lot of Americans who see Congress as a group that's proposing a lot of bad ideas in terms of policy. But at the same time, there are must-pass pieces of legislation, like appropriations bills, that gridlock really threatens, and that increases the likelihood of government shutdowns, lacks of reauthorization for essential agencies, and a whole host of other problems.
John, what could the president do without a Republican Congress? If that is indeed what we get after the midterms, and where do you think the focus will be?
Well, presidents face this fairly regularly, right? The past several presidents have faced a period of unified government and then a period in which they lost control of at least one house of Congress. And they handle it in different ways. An effective president takes a deep breath and says, well, the political landscape has changed dramatically, and if I want to be effective at all, I have to become a deal maker. And for President Trump, he sort of prides himself on that, and I think he has an opportunity to change course a bit. If, however, he stays course, given a different political environment, it means that he will contribute to that gridlock, and any hope of breaking that gridlock, of course, comes from the Oval Office. And if the Oval Office is not willing to put in the time, then gridlock is the name of the game.
Who was the last effective president, John?
Well, you know, I think it's not often talked about, but I think President George W. Bush actually worked surprisingly well with Democrats in Congress after the 2006 wave of Democrats taking control. I mean, they didn't, you know, they didn't do everything that they wanted to get done, but they weren't as antagonistic as people thought they'd be.
And John, this goes to the heart of your academics, which is the idea of a president with executive experience. And we can clearly state that President Trump did not have that, not serving in government, and that President Obama was Senator Obama. Do you make a big deal of someone that enters the office that actually was a governor?
I think that's pretty helpful. When you look at President Clinton, who worked well with a Republican Congress, or I should say relatively well, President Bush, who worked well with a Democratic Congress, part of that had to do with their experience previously. But I think with President Trump, you know, he is an executive. He is a business executive. And in his many decades of working, not just in New York, but in other other major cities around the world, he saw these changes in political environments, real estate environments, and economic environments, and to be effective, he needed to change when those environments changed. And so I think he has an opportunity to do this. Right. The question is whether he will.
The president's tone, and I believe I saw the video in the blur of the weekend, but John Hudak, can the president get tax legislation through by the first Tuesday of November?
Absolutely not.
The Thank you.
Not going to get anything through between now and this next election day, or frankly, now in November of 2019.
So let's talk foreign policy, John, because that's where the focus is right now.
Yeah, that's right.
Saudi Arabia. Would it be fair to say this is the biggest foreign policy crisis so far of the Trump administration?
Absolutely. I think some are looking at this, or I should say very few are looking at this, as an issue of a journalist being tortured and dismembered. But this is, of course, much larger. It has to do with American values and leadership around the world, respect for media, and, of course, economic and defense relationships. And Saudi Arabia is an important economic partner and an important partner in America's defense. But we have a lot of partners who do things from time to time that appalls the U.S., and there has to be a response to that. And the president right now is facing a crossroads, and he can make a very bad choice, and he can make a series of better choices. And the ball is really in his court.
So walk me through, John, what you think are a series of better choices.
You know, I think a series of better choices includes a serious reprimand of Saudi Arabia. That would probably come in the form of some mild sanctions. It would come from a very, firm statement from the president, and probably a firm statement from the Congress, that the United States does not condone this behavior, and it will stand up for media around the world, who, frankly, as you both know, are under attack in a variety of countries every day.
John, one more question. What happens the first Wednesday of November? I mean, if there's a, let's assume the Democrats take the House. What's the lame duck character of, I mean, John Farrow's looking at me like, what's lame duck? Explain lame duck to our global audience, and what flavor of lame duck will this be?
Sure. A lame duck exists for a Congress or for a president, and that happens after an election and before either a new Congress is sworn in or a new president is sworn in. What you're going to see in the lame duck is a Senate that is rapidly approving judges as quickly as they can. I think that's going to be true even if Republicans maintain control. There are some loose ends in terms of appropriations, a farm bill, et cetera, that Congress wants to get through. And I think sanctions on Saudi Arabia is something that this Congress is going to want to get done before January.
John, thank you so much. John Hudak with Brookings to give us a good election briefing. John, why don't you bring in Young Maley on the equity markets?
Matt Maley, Miller Tabak and Co., LLC, Managing Director and Equity Strategist. Good morning to you, Matt. Big week for tech earnings this week in America. What are you looking for?
Well, I mean, it's it's going to be very, very important because the tech has obviously been the key leader in the market in the stock market since the election. Remember, everybody said that President Trump was going to be negative for tech companies, and the group was getting hit right after the election. And they've rallied strongly since then. The one concern, of course, is the key leader within the tech group has been the semiconductors, and they've been acting very poorly lately. They've been much weaker than the rest of the group. We keep talking about the 200-day moving average in the S&P 500, which we continue to cling to. The same thing is in the XLK, the tech ETF, but the SOX semiconductor index, or the SMH, which is the semi ETF, it's broken well below its 200-day moving average, 7% below, and it's a very, very important support level for that one as well. So if we don't get this group to turn around and for the general group to see good earnings to help the tech group, the key leadership group bounce back, we're going to have some more headwinds as we move through the rest
of the
year.
Matt, just to break down tech a little bit more, we have seen a divergence within the big FANG names themselves, notably the difference between, say, Facebook and Netflix through 2018 has been quite dramatic. Are there any particular names, any companies, any business models that you think will do better in the current environment?
Well, I mean, the one thing that we have to look at is this whole thing with – it's kind of funny because away from the fundamental side of the situation, I'm more interested in how crowded this trade is. You talk about the FANG stocks. You look at a Facebook. You know, in this most recent downturn, Facebook has actually outperformed. It's come down a little bit, but it's actually been trading more sideways. A lot of these stocks are very, very crowded because they perform very well. But Facebook, of course, it's been washed out. It's down more than 20%. It's no longer crowded. It's not a lot of weak money in it. So okay. I think some of these underperformers are going to do better.
It's October, whatever it is, and we're all focused on the first Tuesday of November. Michael Purvis of Whedon, Matt Maley, wrote a wonderful note a number of weeks ago, about how portfolios have to adjust. What percent of portfolios are behind right now? The answer is it's ginormous, isn't it?
Yes, it's of course, every year it's kind of funny how badly the money managers, both on the hedge fund side and on the mutual fund side, tend to underperform the market. The thing is, nowadays it's on a percentage basis. It's a big percentage, but a lot of them are very tied very closely to these indexes, so they're not well behind the market. However, it's kind of funny because I still think we might need to get a little bit of a washout here before the market really bottoms. But as you get past the election, we all know that in midterm election years, the market tends to rally towards the end of the year. Then performance fear plays a huge, huge component to what's going on in the marketplace. Even if you think we're going to have a horrible recession in 2019, if the market's rallying at the end of the year and you're an institutional money manager, right, you've got to be in the market. You've got to be buying. So, people need to be a little bit careful, especially on some of these groups that are very badly beaten up. Some of the bank stocks, which have rallied strongly at the end of the year the last 2 years. I've been very negative on the group, but I you've got to be careful on that one.
Are you saying go to cash?
No. Take it back. Yes, I think right now, I think as we look into 2019, with interest rates moving higher, things have changed. We keep saying the fundamentals haven't changed. Mortgage rates have doubled. I'm sorry, not doubled. They've gone up a full percent in the last year. Long-term bonds have doubled since the middle of 2016, the yield on long-term bonds. There's a lot of uncertainty now with earnings. So my thing is raise a little bit of cash in case we have a tough year. Get a little bit more defensive because these defensive groups are outperforming, especially healthcare.
Matt Maley, thank you so much, Miller Tape. I greatly appreciate it. Without question, my interview of the day on the issues of Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States. Stephen A. Cook, is with the Council on Foreign Relations. I can't say enough about his book, False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence, A Look at the Middle East, A Look at the Arab Spring. It is one of those books where I'm reading every word cover to cover. Stephen Cook, good morning. If you wrote False Dawn today, how would you change a chapter on Turkey?
Well, I think the chapter actually holds up even stronger now. Turkey was one of those countries in the early 2000s that I think people widely believed would be a member of the European Union by 2018. And it is more authoritarian now than I think it's been in since it, the Republic of Turkey's founding almost 90-some-odd years ago. So the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, essentially runs a one-man elected autocracy.
Within this is a present for Mr. Erdogan in his autocracy. Would you explain his calculus now? I think it's been confusing within the media. The Erdogan calculus with Saudi Arabia combined with the calculuses to the United States and to Iran as well.
Well, the issue of the day being the relationship between Turkey and Saudi Arabia. And I think it's fairly clear that Erdogan has multiple interests in doing everything possible to embarrass the Saudis. First of all, he can demonstrate through the leaks to the press that Turkey can be a responsible citizen as opposed to a reckless Saudi Arabia. He's scheduled to announce tomorrow the Turkish government's belief of what happened to this Saudi journalist, Jamal Khashoggi. And I think what he's trying to do is to demonstrate that for all the criticism that the Turkish press has taken for its past fabrications on this issue, they've been 100% on the story and have reflected accurately what's happened. And then it's important to remember that Saudi Arabia is a rival and actually in conflict with one of Turkey's strategic allies, the government of Qatar. And so anything that Erdogan can do to kind of bring the Saudis down a notch will be beneficial to him. On the question of Iran, the Turks really have played a double game. They have signaled publicly that they want to be on the side of the United States, while over the course of the preceding decade, helped the Iranians evade UN sanctions. So it's entirely unclear what they're going to do with the renewed sanctions.
Stephen A. Cook with his Council on Foreign Relations. I can't say enough about False Dawn. I'm reading it cover to cover. Stephen A. Cook, this came up this weekend. Let's have the pro answer the question. If the Saudis are Sunni and the Iranians are Shia, what is Turkey?
Well, Turkey is predominantly a Sunni country, but the Turks have never really pursued a sectarian foreign policy in the same way that the Saudis have, for example, or the way the Iranians have. The Turks see themselves as natural leaders of the Muslim world, and that includes Sunni and Shia.
Within all this is where we go from here. Of course, CNN leading with a report this morning of a double coming out of the consulate that looked like Mr. Khashoggi and all that. What is a pro like you monitoring over the next 24, over the next 72 hours?
Well, what's really, I think, crucially important is the way in which the Saudi government responds to these revelations. It is a situation which is obviously very, very difficult for the Saudis to get out of. The stories they've told are not believable. This is going to shake the royal family. Even if Mohammed bin Salman remains the crown prince, look for the king to rein him in a bit and for his enemies to regain some ground within the royal family.
How do you depose Mohammed bin Salman? If the royal family decides to do that, he's not the king, so I guess he's not deposable, but have you figured out a path yet to what the royal family would do?
I think it's unlikely that the king will depose his son, and it's really up to the king. So any enemies of Mohammed bin Salman will have to depose King Salman, and it's going to be very hard. The crown prince and the king control all of the important services, the military, the Ministry of Interior, the Saudi Arabian National Guard, that could be the instruments of toppling the king. But one can imagine that as Mohammed bin Salman gets pulled deeper and deeper into this scandal, that the king and people around him determine that the young crown prince is doing a disservice to Saudi Arabia. And some of those people who had been previously been sidelined, been brought back as steady hands for the kingdom.
Stephen, in the time that we've got left with you, let's pull it back to the United States. Can you rate Secretary Pompeo's shuttle diplomacy of last week? And what would be the next step for the Secretary of State?
Well, I think that the administration is caught in an extraordinarily awkward position. Two allies, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, have vastly different stories. And I think that Pompeo's effort to try to get the Saudis on board to at least telling something that's believable so that we can get past that wasn't entirely successful. I think the administration is growing frustrated with the Saudis, and it's time for them to take them on publicly and say, you have to come clean.
Does the Trump administration have a Middle East policy? I see Jerusalem and the embassy there now. Australia is considering that as well. But do they have a Stephen A. Cook policy you can find?
I think it's focus on countering Iran, which is why the administration has been reluctant to come out swinging against the Saudis on the death of Jamal Khashoggi. It is to destroy the Islamic State. And in doing both of those things, it's maximum support for America's allies in the region, most of whom are authoritarian systems.
Stephen, thank you for the update. Stephen A. Cook with the Council on Foreign Relations. And again, just the highest recommendation of his short, brief, terse book, False Dawn, on the Arab Spring and the path from that. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.